Hello and welcome to Joe's Boys. This is a podcast for little women, little men, and everyone in between. I'm your host, Peyton Thomas. I'm the author of the novel Both Sides Now. I'm also a writer for publications like Vanity Fair and the New York Times. And I'm here today with my very special guest, Tori Peters. Tori is the author of the, I'm going to say iconic novel, Detransition Baby, which won the Penn Hemingway Award for Best Debut Novel. It was also a finalist for the Lambda Literary Award, the National Book Critics Circle Award, and the Gotham Book Prize. And a long listee for the Women's Prize, plus more than 20 publications named it one of the best books of 2021. So basically, run out and buy it. Pause the podcast. What are you doing if you haven't already read it? Tori's next book, Infect Your Friends and Loved Ones, is forthcoming. In the meantime, she's busy riding a pink motorcycle, and she splits her time between Brooklyn and an off-grid cabin in Vermont. Tori, welcome to the show. How are you?
Hi, I'm really happy to be here. I was just listening to you do that. You have a great podcast voice. Do people tell you that?
I mean, couldn't No, that's the first time.
It's literally looking at you like, it, you know, all the people can't see us behind one of those professional microphones. So maybe I'm like fooled by the image. But as this was happening, I was like, this is like NPR. This was a good, good intro. Well, I'm super happy to be here. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, thank you so much. It's very exciting to have you here. I've obviously been a fan for a long time of Detransition Baby, and I'm really looking forward to the novella as well. I mean, take your time with it, let it marinate, but very much looking forward to that. Yeah, I also can't take credit for the professional podcast, Mike. This is all, as I was saying just before we got started, this is the generosity of the Toronto Public Library, which has recording studios that anyone can use for free. So shout out to your local library. Tori, what's your relationship to Little Women?
I have almost no relationship to Little Women.
Okay.
Had never read it. I had not seen either of the movies. And I read it just for this podcast.
That's so cool.
I have no preconceptions. I feel like growing up, I feel like a lot of people, they were either like Little Women or there was Little House on the Prairie. Mine was a Little House on the Prairie household. So we did not read Little Women in the Peters household.
Yes.
And even though it was in the background of my life, I was never stirred to pick it up. I don't know why. So that's my relationship.
Your relationship. So it's so cool that you're reading it here for the very first time. This is one of my favorite things about this podcast is I had the president of the Louisa May Alcott Society on and the past president. And then I'll have people like you who come in and are like, just reading it for the first time. And we get your raw impressions. That's very cool. So you said that you were a Little House household. And that leads into a follow-up question from one of our listeners, Stephen Ira. And he says he wants to know what you loved reading as a kid.
Well, my family's from the Midwest. My mom was, her family was, I don't know, they were some sort of rural farm style people in that Wisconsin and prairie stuff. So I think it was, they kind of went with the territory. I think they were not, were they Norwegian, the Little House on the Prairie people?
Gosh, or like
Norwegian?
I don't know. You might be thinking of Kirsten, who is the American Girl Pioneer doll.
Oh, definitely.
And she was Swedish. Yes.
I'm definitely thinking of the American Girl. I'm confused. My sister was doing Kirsten. My grandma was actually an orphan or something along those lines. Seems like it's weird, it's unclear, but I think it was just different family. They were sharecroppers.
Yeah.
And I think it was unclear. Cloud and lineages, but we are Norwegian. That was the family idea. And so they, on that side of the family, so they did Norwegian Christmas. And so I think American Girls and Little House on the Prairie was somehow, it was their version, my family's version of Americana, which I thought about a lot as I was reading this. What Americana do you get as you read your childhood books?
Yeah.
So 100%. Little House on the Prairie and then I feel like I was given a lot of Calvin and Hobbes comics.
Okay.
As a kid.
Solid choice. Yeah.
Yeah. When I was maybe a fourth grader, and I was always trying to do that things that Calvin did, like give my father a poll on, you know, how he was doing, or I don't know. I copied a lot from Calvin.
Yeah. We were big Calvin and Hobbes fans in my house. My older brother had a giant stuffed tiger that we all called Hobbes. So that was Yeah, no, and you're also, you're not the first person to say Little House and Little Women were parallel to each other in your life. I'm also not surprised to hear that you were reading both the Kirsten books and Little House because they have the same illustrator.
I didn't realize.
Amazing woman named Renee Grief, who has one of the best Instagrams because she's always posting her delightful little pencil crayon sketches. I shouldn't say like that minimizes them. They're incredibly intricate little pencil crayon sketches, right. But so highly recommend. And now, are you a Kirsten? Is that where you fall in the American Girl doll universe?
The American Girl, so there was Molly, was yes. Am I right? Was that with glasses?
Yes, correct. Yeah.
It was Kirsten. There was a red-haired one.
Felicity, yes.
Right. There was a black girl. Who was the black girl?
Addie, yeah.
Abby. And then there was the Kirsten. Who am I missing?
I mean, there's 20 of them now. There's 90s.
Oh, there's 20.
Yeah. They just introduced 90s historical characters.
Oh, okay.
Twins from the Pacific Northwest, and one is Butch, and one is all in pink.
I feel like when it came out, when I remember it, there was original four or five.
Yeah.
And I was not, I was not given an option to choose one.
Right.
I just read my sister's stuff.
Yeah.
And I remember also, here's this thing that I read actually as a kid.
Yeah.
I read Saddle Club because my sister was, it was like the Babysitter's Club spinoff was Saddle Club, you know?
Yes. Oh my God.
My sister likes Saddle Club better than Babysitter's Club. So I read that also, taking them from my sister.
Yeah.
But I don't know. I don't remember the personalities of America.
Sure, sure. That's you know, that's fair.
To be honest, their personalities felt very. Well, Molly had glasses, so she must have been studious.
Yeah, that's.
So I don't know if I can remember back enough to relate to the personalities. I'd be a lot better an answer if I was like, I'm definitely an athlete, you know, whatever.
Right, right.
It is.
No, I understand. For some people, it either sort of. I only ask because you have. It seems like very clear memories of Kirsten.
Yeah. Well, that was the American Girl who lived in our household with us.
Yes, yes. Understandable. Yeah. So then in line with that question, having just read all of Little Women, and this is very exciting, which March sister are you? And keep in mind, for the purposes of this podcast, Lori is a March sister.
I would say I'm like half Amy, half Lori, I guess.
Ooh, fantastic.
Say.
Okay. Yeah. Well, this is a great chapter to talk about with you then. Why are you Amy Sun, Lori Moon, or the other way around? I don't know.
I relate to Amy's, her sort of half desire to be popular, but also knowing that it's a little bit denigrates her a little bit, you know?
Yeah.
And wanting to be an artist, but discovering the differences between talent and genius and all those sort of things. And I also think she's somewhat intrepid, would say.
Yeah.
I mean, I know she didn't really choose to go to Europe, but I feel like, you know, she is the one who traveled and I think she's fairly intrepid. So I relate to her flaws and the way she seems to try and overcome her flaws. And then Lori, too, has very moody, you know?
Yes.
And I relate to Lori's moodiness. I relate to a little bit being spoiled, but in a way he's constantly a little bit thinking that he's special, you know?
Yeah.
And then has to kind of be like, actually, maybe I'm not that special, you know? Maybe actually my life is going to reject me. And like, you know, I'm not. The stories that I'm telling myself don't perfectly correspond to reality because while everybody sort of dotes on him, I think he receives like some major rejections in the book.
Yeah.
And I kind of relate to that.
Okay. Yeah. I have felt myself very much on the Lori side of the Joe Lori dynamic and the Joe side. I've been both parties and it's hard every time, but I definitely hear you. And I'm glad that you're talking to us right up top about Lori and Amy, because this is the moment happens. Yeah.
The Lori Amy chapter.
Lori
finally, after being courted by all of the March women.
Yes.
Well, I guess, Meg at the beginning, everyone thought that Meg and Lori were going to be together.
They thought Meg and Lori were the sure thing. Joe thought for a second Beth had a crush on Lori, and that turned out to just be projection or something. But no, it's all coming together here. They're going official. Tori, will you recap chapter 41, Learning to Forget?
So this is basically after... Beth has died in the previous chapter, and also Lori has been told off by Amy also. Those are like some of the precursors to this, which I guess our listeners of your podcast already know this. But
yes,
for me, making sense of it was like to remember those things. And then basically Lori is in Europe reflecting on why, on both the speech that he was given by Amy about how he's a wastrel and, you know, his pain of rejection from Joe. And he basically is like, I'm going to show Joe that she made a mistake. I'm going to be a genius. I'm going to go, you know, write incredible music about her. And then he goes and he can't quite write the incredible music. It just isn't happening for him. It's not there. And then he's underneath a picture of Mozart and he remembers that Mozart, when one sister didn't work out for Mozart, Mozart just married the other sister. And he was like, not in so many words. He's kind of like, hey, if it's good enough for Mozart, it's good enough for me. Which is actually quite presumptuous in a number of ways. Yeah. One, that he's Mozart, this guy who can't make any music. Then he's like, I'm just like Mozart. The sisters are swappable. Mm-hmm. But it turns out they kind of were swappable in our works. Yeah. So then he gets a letter from Amy saying that Beth has died and he runs to console Amy. And then he and Amy start hanging out and the chapter ends. I thought it was a pretty good marriage proposal, which is, so basically, this is something I noticed that Lucy May Alcott does a lot of this. She says, now in stories, it's supposed to go like this.
Yes.
And then she says what her story is supposed to do.
Yeah.
So she was like, in stories, you're supposed to make a big speech. And Lori was going to make a big speech for Joe. And you'd think that he made a big speech for Amy. But actually what happened is they were just in a rowboat and they're rowing well together. And Lori says, would you like to row this way forever? And Amy's like, I do. And that's the end of the chapter. And then they're an item.
They're
married. They're engaged.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah. I think what happens is the title of the next chapter is All Alone. So that's Joe being alone and miserable. And then the next chapter is Surprises. And the surprise is that Amy and Lori arrive and they're married.
Yeah.
So we don't get a grand wedding scene with Amy and Lori. We just get this sort of quiet moment in the rowboat, which is interesting. And let's maybe start there at the end, because this is, we get sort of three marriages in this book. And every time the proposal scene gets a little gender fucky. And here, what's interesting is that rather than Lori going down on one knee for Amy, they're rowing together. Amy offers to row and Lori says, well, I'm not tired, so that's not necessary. But if you want, you can sit beside me and take an oar. So it's immediately this incredibly egalitarian image of they're sitting side by side and they each have an oar and they're rowing together. And that's the way that Alcott introduces to us the idea of their marriage, is that they're going to be sitting side by side performing the same duty. And it's, I don't know how I feel entirely about Lori and Amy. I guess we'll work through that together. This is therapy. Yeah. But it's nice that Alcott sort of flips the script in that respect. She's saying, even though Amy is the most traditionally feminine, this is not going to be a marriage where she doesn't work or doesn't pull her own weight and he just looks after her. They each have a role together. And what do you make of that image, the rowboat?
I mean, I feel like it was the only marriage thing that moves me in the entire book.
Yeah,
I mean, I did not, Brooke and Meg and the sort of whole discussion of, I mean, I found him kind of awful in the way and the advice sort of, hey, look, you should always have food ready for him. But, you know, hey, maybe also he can help out with the child rearing kind of stuff.
Yeah.
That was a little bit of a hint of egalitarianness, I guess, because it was like, maybe you should help out with the kids, Brooke. But it was still pretty, you know, you're lucky to have a man kind of. And then I didn't really like that the professor told Joe, you know, not to write the naughty stories. I wasn't so into that. And so here was one that was, you know, they're very similar, right? They both wanted to be genius artists. They didn't actually work out as genius artists. They both sort of had the potential to be popular society people and they didn't really do it. And so there's a way in which they're well fitted to each other. Their strengths are the similar strengths.
Yes.
And so why wouldn't they be egalitarian? Why wouldn't they both be rowing? You know, it made sense to me. And that, and the simplicity of, hey, do you want to do this with me? That actually felt real in a way that a bunch of the other proposals and speechless, didn't you? Are we going to do this? All right.
Yep.
You know, that was, it didn't make for a good speech, but it made for a lot.
Yeah.
It would be good in a rom-com. Rom-com after all the tumult and this and that.
Yeah.
And you just, it, it turns out you don't need the big wedding. You just pull a oar and that's the lesson you learned. It was a super good rom-com screenwriting moment.
Yeah, I agree. And it's funny. We talked with one of the actresses from the PBS adaptation of Little Women. And in that version, they're not in a physical rowboat, but Laurie and Amy make little paper boats. And the paper boats get stuck together in the river and they're going the same way, stuck together. And they're like, oh, guess that's stuck with me. So it, it does.
Seems like a budget issue on the part of PBS.
We might, I think so. But it's... So we have seen that on screen before in, albeit lower budget form. But what's interesting is that as soon as, so Amy says, how well we pull together, don't we? And Laura goes, oh, so well that I wish we may always pull in the same boat. Will you, Amy? Yes, Laurie. And then they both stopped rowing. And we can imagine what they did when they stopped rowing. It's
I didn't realize that was a fade to black. That's like
it was. It's a fate to black. They stopped rowing and unconsciously added a pretty little tableau of human love and happiness to the dissolving views reflected in the lake. And so they're making out in the boat. It's funny to, there's some earlier fade to black scenes between Meg and John Brooke, including one fade to black where it's 9 months later, the twins arrive.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
So, I mean, we can, she leaves it up to your imagination what they get up to in the boat. I think it's funny, these Alcott didn't have a lot of romance in her own life, right? She said very late in her life that she'd been in love with ever so many pretty girls and never once the least little bit with any man. Huh. And that was a reply to a question she was asked. She said, I feel as though I am by some freak of nature, a man's soul in a woman's body. Her interviewer asked her why, and she was like, well, for one thing, so many pretty girls. Yeah. But then earlier, much earlier in her life, she met a boy named Ladislas Wisniewski while she was traveling in Europe, who was one of the inspirations for Laurie. And we know from her journals and letters that she kissed him and that they traveled together in Europe. But the page of her journal where she reflects on that relationship, she scratched it out so hard that she actually tore the paper and it's unreadable. And in the margins, she wrote, couldn't be. So... That's sort of all we know about Alcott's own romantic life. And she never married. She didn't seem to want to for various reasons. She didn't want to have biological children. So it's interesting to look at these love scenes or the proposals and kind of think about why Alcott is writing them this way or why this scene seems incredibly deliberately to sort of efface the heterosexuality and the sentimentality from it and instead make it this very human moment that's not really gendered in any way, although we do hear that Amy has to use both hands to row, where Laurie only has to use one. So,
yeah.
So that's sort of the only thing, but
maybe it's, do you think it's, I don't know, I'm just thinking about, I don't know anything about this in the Alcott. I'm just learning this as you say it, but
yeah.
I'm also thinking about different ways that you can love people.
Yeah.
And that sometimes if you love people and you're like, I don't know if I want this person or really want to be them.
Yes.
And if she's with, and she's like, it can't be.
Yeah.
If the question is, can't be, can we not be together or can we not be two?
Yes. Yeah.
Two handsome buddies bopping around Europe, you know,
which
in some ways they're buddies in this. Like, we're just two buddies in a boat, you know, having a good time.
Yeah, she doesn't even give us a majestic kiss. She just sort of fades out before that happens and lets you sort of fill in the blank as a reader. I think you're very much onto something because the can we be two buddies palling around, that's a question that Joe actually poses to Laurie. Can we be, let's run away together to India as two boys? It's a question
that
the real life Lou Alcott posed to Alfie Whitman, who is another of the inspirations for Laurie. And in this letter, which is insane, she's like, I just left my job as a governess, so I'm a gentleman about town. I'm free. And what do you say? You and I run off and be sailors on a boat somewhere. There was a real longing to be a boy with another boy, not even necessarily in a romantic sense, but just let's be boys and buddy around.
That's in some ways how this ends, right?
Yes.
The two of them running away on a boat.
Yep.
You know, and the boat is a rowboat, but they're running away together on a boat.
Completely. Yeah.
So there is, and I kind of like that that who does that happen with? It happens with Amy, not with Joe, right?
Yeah.
There's actually not the sort of, oh, the boyish one
Yeah.
Is the one you knew. It's actually anybody can run away as buddies on a boat.
And you know, you point to something so funny there, which is another thing that Alcott does in love scenes beyond just kind of move toward gender equality, which obviously that explicit, we get a couple chapters of Meg being married and working through that and being like, John, you have to take care of the kids kind of thing.
Yeah.
But in that fade to black sex scene with Meg that we talked about earlier, it comes on the heels of Meg has just splurged on all the silk for a new gown. Now John can't have a winter coat. She feels terrible. So she sells the silk, buys a winter coat, and then he comes home and she's wearing the winter coat. She's wearing the men's coat. And it's like, what do you think of my dress? And then fade to black and the babies appear. So it's in that sex scene, it's literally Meg is cross-dressing.
Right.
Alcott is like, now how would I?
To put on a sexy outfit, a great coat.
A man's great coat. And it's so funny because I get the sense of when she's trying to imagine how love would work or what she would want, she puts this spin on it that it's like, no, I don't want the very traditional down on one knee thing, even if that's what readers are expecting. I'm going to give you this instead, which is very interesting to me.
And I feel actually like they get more that way as the book goes on. First one, I remember because the book is sort of chaste in what it shows.
Yes.
I remember the first time that Joe comes in and Meg is sitting on Burke's lap.
Yep.
And I was like, on John Burke's lap, and I was like, whoa, that is forward. That is a little, tone it down.
Yeah. Like,
which was, but that was like very, you know, a man and his wife, you know, a man and his wife and his man. And by the end, it doesn't seem like they're doing that as much anymore.
Yeah.
You know, or maybe the success of the first book was like, I don't really have to. You know?
Yeah. So the proposal sort of ties up part one. And then the second half, in the interim, basically Alcott got a zillion letters being like, who are the little women going to marry? Please tell me Joe is going to marry Lori. So it was these young girl readers who were very much expecting something. And she wrote this book in some ways to piss them off. She wrote very consciously. She was like, I'm making a weirdo for Joe. Joe is not going to marry Lori. Yeah. That's not happening.
Yeah.
So it's interesting how so many readers from the original publication to now see Joe and Lori as the very obvious thing and almost resent Lori and Amy getting together. They see it as like a pairing off of the spare parts. And I'm wondering, do you see Lori and Amy as a natural thing? You think that they're a good match. Why do you think Amy is a better match for Lori than Joe?
I mean, this is all stuff again. This is new to me.
Yeah, yeah.
I never thought that Joe and Lori I never thought they'd get together.
Interesting.
I was like, this seems to make them get together feels, like forcing two people who really don't belong to a kind of relationship that they shouldn't have. And, you know, the whole sort of sister-brother metaphor from the start meant to me that I was like, they should not get together, you know, and they're sort of like incest. I mean, not quite incest taboo, but there was it would be like forcing Joe into a situation that really isn't her deal.
Yeah.
So I never thought that they were right for each other. And not having ever read the book, I thought it was going to be like a weird situation where early on when it was hinted that Meg was going to marry Lori, I thought that the way the plot was going to go was that Meg was going to marry Lori. And that in that marriage, Lori would be closer to Joe.
Right.
And that would be a source of tension. I mean, one of the weird things for me with this book is that I found it to be almost experimental. You know, whereas it was happening, I was like, I mean, it's definitely very episodic. I was like, you know, knowing that I was reading for podcasts and I was like, okay, what's the plot of this book? And I kept on waiting to sort of pick up plot threads, especially early on. There wasn't really plot threads.
It was just short stories. Yeah.
Yeah. And it was super episodic, super, you know, well, that story just all wraps up. Now we meet the characters again. And then also there's like all the sort of detritus of other forms that makes its way in, poetry and songs and letters and newspaper articles or whatever, all just kind of in there. And so I was like, I actually don't know what this book is about. And so early on, I was like guessing what the plot would be.
The
little fragments of plot that were there made me think that it was going to be a love triangle between Meg,
interesting,
Lori, and Joe, which obviously is totally wrong. But that seemed to be the early goes. Yeah. And I was like, oh, that's going to be it. And so then when that was frustrated, I had really no expectations that Lori was going to marry any of them.
Interesting. You know? Yeah.
And in fact, it was like the whole chapter that we're talking about, it all felt super abrupt to me. You know, Meg's death was kind of off stage. There was, you know, the way that Lori got over Joe was, it was really, it was like, I tried to write some music and I couldn't write music.
Yeah.
I wish that I could get over relationships by just not writing shit. That'd be great, you know? Amazing. Yeah. I failed at something else and now I feel wonderful. It was not that there was a scene at the end, but there were so few actual scenes and so few. It was all summary. So then when they did get together, it was like, wow, that was mostly off camera. Almost everything that happened was off camera. So again, I guess that speaks to the idea that like it was not that natural to put them together because they're how Lori sort of organically gets over Joe is not clear. Lori sort of truly falls in love with Amy other than swapping sisters a la Mozart.
Yeah.
Is not very clear, you know?
No.
And you just sort of have to go with that logic and you're like, oh, I guess these two are together now. And, you know, and in that he's rich and that Amy wanted somebody who's rich, I guess you're like, well, it satisfies that parameter, which was clear from the start that Amy had to marry a rich one. But so I guess that was like a hidden clue that they were going to get together. But otherwise, it didn't feel fated that they should get together, but it definitely also did not feel as bad as if I think it had been the whole thing about Joe. That's just for my feelings, which is apparently contrary to hundreds of years of other readers.
Yeah, it's so, I love that you bring us to thinking about how Amy and Lori get together, which like you say off camera, it's pretty much the entire span of this one chapter.
Yeah.
Lori goes from heartbroken over Joe. I'm looking at it right now, that toward the end of the chapter, he says, Joe's sister was almost the same as Joe's self. So in some ways, it's very unromantic.
Which is not true. We just had the entire book differentiating that.
Which really, I mean, you can point to similarities. Amy and Joe are both the more ambitious kind of, they're ambitious. They have plans to travel and make art. So they...
But the other two are dead or married. So it's like...
Yeah. So a couple of times, like, well, he couldn't have one sister, so he took the other. In the 1994 movie, where Christian Bale plays Lori, which is interesting if you've only ever seen Christian Bale as Batman, as I had, he gives Amy a speech that is, just as you have always known that you were supposed to marry rich, I knew that I always had to be a March. So he's kind of saying, you're the last one left. He says, I hate John Brooke. I hate the professor. If Beth had a lover, I would hate him too. So they make it very explicitly. He just wants to be a part of this family. And marriage is sort of the only reason he can do that. I think it's interesting that you're coming in as a newbie and you're seeing this love triangle and then that doesn't transpire. And then you have no idea where Lori's going. I agree. I don't think Joe and Lori belong together as a heterosexual couple in 1868. And I think Joe very wisely is like, this isn't what I want from you. And it's heartbreaking for Joe, I think, because she does want Lori to be part of her family, but just not like that. And I wanted to reread Detransition Baby before we recorded this episode, because the key tension of that book, right, is, so just for anyone who hasn't read it, the people at home, essentially this character Ames gets his boss pregnant, and they're deciding what to do about the pregnancy. Ames discloses to his boss, Katrina, that he thought he was sterile because he used to live as a transgender woman. And I'm using Ames and he, because like, that's where we are in the contemporary of, right?
I use he pronouns in myself.
Yeah. Ames has detransitioned and is like, I can't be a father. That is not happening. I can't be a father. I don't want to be a father. And the only way that Ames can figure out to sort of live with being a parent at all is to bring his ex-girlfriend in as a co-mother. So it's this incredibly unconventional form of family making that they're engaging in, because Ames says to Katrina, I am transgender, but it's simply too hard to live as a trans woman. Ames had been was like publicly beaten up on the street in a moment that was really difficult for him. And so he's put this part of him in a shelf and he's saying, I don't know if I will always be a man or if I will transition again. So with that very on the fly summary, and I apologize, Tori, because I'm saying it right to you.
Well done. Well done. You should be my publicist.
We come to Little Women and Jo loves Lori and Lori loves Jo, and the traditional boy-girl romantic relationship is simply not happening for them. And it's so funny because what ends up happening ultimately, and this is far, we're in sequel number 3 at this point, is Jo opens this school and then Lori goes and opens a college right next to it. And so then they and their families are all living on this big campus together. And Jo and Lori are still just the best of friends and have cute nicknames for each other. And they're all kind of raising their family in one big blob. Which, interestingly enough, the way that Alcott's own family worked out is her older sister, the real life Meg, her husband died. And Alcott wrote in her journal, "I must be a father to these children." And kind of took on that role. And the kids would call her Papa. And then later on, the real life Amy passed away and left a child, which then Alcott adopted and became a mother. So it was this, it's again, just I'm thinking about unconventional family structures and the way that in Little Women, we see both in the work and in Alcott's own life, kind of a rebelling against the traditional mother-father family structure. Do you detect any of that in Little Women? Did it prefigure detransition, baby?
I mean, you know, one of the things that stood out for me a lot in this book was how religious it is,
yeah.
You know, and how much the ideas of religion structured the family. And so there's sort of like what the book said, especially in the long speeches by Mrs. March about here's what the family should be. And which I actually found, again, more moving than I expected. And I was like, this is actually really good life advice, even if it's couched in, you know, loving God a lot. And so what the book basically had was a very, never mind later on, and because I haven't read it, but early on, what you had was a very traditional family. You had a mother and a father, and the father situation. You know, he's the one who knows. He's the one who holds together the family. She, you know, sacrifices for him, et cetera. That's the rhetoric around the family. And then the reality in the book is that he's totally absent.
Yeah, completely. Even when he comes home.
That's what I mean. When he came home, I thought something would change. But instead, he's just basically, here's who your roles are. And then you never hear about him. He's just he's bumbling around as a minister somewhere, I guess, talking to whoever. But not his daughters. And so there's like the rhetoric of here's a traditional family. And then it was almost like the traditional family couldn't bring herself to actually do it. She could say it, but she couldn't do it. And that was weird for me in terms of kind of family structures. And I have to say, I almost was like, this is precisely what I don't like, is that when you preach a sort of traditional family and what you end up when you preach this traditional family is an absentee father, you know? And so it was sort of like living out sort of the faults of this very, or dramatizing the faults of the philosophy while also protesting that this is actually working. So that the Mr. March character really didn't do much for me because he wasn't there. And the family structure didn't, as it was preached, did not really do much for me. It's interesting to think about it as an alternative family also, though, because I've also been thinking about myself. The idea of gentleness in men that is, you know, was really a 19th century sort of, the men were really supposed to be gentle. They were, they were strong, but they really, like, the ideal man is a very gentle man.
Yeah.
He's not macho. He's not, and you can rely on him and you can lean on him, but he's not. And so in that Mr. March was that, I found that really interesting, but it almost made him so retiring and gentle that he couldn't exist.
Yeah. He's a very sort of a ghostly figure in the book. He's physically not there, as you're saying, for the first part. Then when he returns, you're expecting something to change and he just disappears. And he's so gentle. There are parts where he's called upon to perform family duties and he can't. And Jo has to step in for him and literally be the man of the household. She says as much in the book, right? I think another thing that's interesting is that, well, we have this kind of all-female family making it work in the form of the Marches, very much against what they're preaching about how marriage is the sweetest thing that can happen to a woman. We don't see the March parents' marriage in action, really. And Lori's parents are dead, right? He's being raised by this grandfather who really seems to resent his presence and a tutor. So Laurie's in this all male world and he seems kind of drawn into this all female family next door, right? And in this chapter, we hear a lot about how he's heartbroken, he's tempted to go to the devil and take up all kind of manly temptations. Mm-hmm. But it's like Alcott says, because so many women have loved him and he has the March family women in his heart, basically, his proximity to their womanhood sort of makes him good and prevents mm-hmm. him from erring as other men might do. And so this was another reader question, but it's something I'm always thinking about with Laurie too, is this notion of Laurie as a trans feminine figure. Did you read that in Laurie at all?
No.
Okay.
I mean, I can see it, but I didn't. I think I saw Laurie much more the way that previously we posited that he's sort of an ideal boyish character.
Yeah.
I mean, I feel like I had these friendships mm-hmm. before I transitioned. And so maybe I'm, a little bit different than Alcott, but I had these friendships with men, mm-hmm. oftentimes charismatic, handsome men, where mm-hmm. I would be... we were like a couple, but in like we were buddies, but we were also, it wasn't totally equal. And and I never knew, and I never quite knew how to make sense of it. I was really drawn to books like Brideshead Revisited and things like that, where you've got the Sebastian character who's so charismatic, and you've got, the Sebastian Flight, and oh my God, I'm blanking out on the
Julia writer. Yeah, Ryder. I was thinking of the
Charles
sister.
Ryder, Sebastian Ryder, the charismatic one who sort of follows around the charismatic boy. Mm-hmm. And I mean, in some ways, even Gatsby is, around the charismatic boy. And mm-hmm. I sort of thought of Laurie as very much the charismatic boy in that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And that Joe was Charles Ryder, or Joe was Nick, and Laurie was a kind of Gatsby, especially as he could go and do all these things that they couldn't mm-hmm. do, and he was rich, and et cetera, et cetera. And so those are the literary models that I saw in him, and for mm-hmm. them to work, he could be queer. Certainly, Sebastian is queer, and Gatsby's got some stuff going on.
He does,
but I think he had to be sort of, and he wasn't exactly. Neither of them were exactly met, right? That's the other thing about Sebastian. Carried around a teddy bear his entire life because he was always sort of like a maternal boy.
Yeah. Aloysius.
Yeah. And that's how I saw Laurie, that Laurie couldn't ever quite be a man. And in that he couldn't be a man, you could say that there's something queer in that, or there's something that chimes with trans femininity, that mm-hmm. you can't ever quite be a man. But in that he wanted to be a woman, I don't know. I don't feel that as much. I feel that if he was to be an eternal boy, the mm-hmm. March sisters are the place of his boyhood. And in order to stay an eternal boy, he must remain with them.
That makes a lot of sense. Yeah.
That's the Sebastian Flight model that I see Laurie in more than I see him. I don't see him as a girl.
Yeah, I understand. I can see that as well. I think a lot of the conflict at the heart of Little Women is Joe not wanting to be a woman, right? But equally...
Yeah.
Not wanting to grow up and not especially because growing up for her means having to be somebody's wife or somebody's mother. And those are roles that she's very much not comfortable in. I think transmasculine Joe is something that people can, that's the case kind of makes itself in the text, right? It's just, I think Greta Gerwig in discussing her versions of Joe and Laurie says Joe and Laurie find each other before they've committed to a gender. And she has notes in their script about how when they're dancing, sometimes Joe is the man and sometimes the woman. Same with Laurie. So I think it is, I see, especially early on, Laurie, he says he doesn't like boys. He doesn't like getting along with them. He wants to go and be a part of the March sisters games. And I think that's an interesting take on the characters. I do see, there are things like, Laurie says he doesn't like boys. They're noisy and rough, and he didn't get along with the boys at his old school. They called him Dora, short for Theodore. So there is something.
I did notice that.
Yeah, there's something not quite man about Laurie, and he just takes to the marches. And I think what's interesting here is when he's trying to get over Joe and he's trying to imagine her as the heroine of his opera, he can only recall Joe's oddities, faults, and freaks, her most unsentimental aspects, beating mats with her head tied up in a bandana. barricading herself with the sofa pillow, throwing cold water over his passion. And instead, his mind shifts to this like very feminine Amy prototype. Right. So I almost feel with Laurie and Amy, there's a femme for femme thing going on. What do you think?
Well, yeah, I could see that. What about... Okay, so I'm going to go back to my thing where I think it's really more about age than gender.
Which makes sense, yeah.
Let me give you a parallel reading. Okay. Which is, why is Joe and Laurie always feeling wrong? And I think the reason that it always feels wrong is if they got together, and is it neither their friendship is a childhood friendship, is not an adult friendship. Mm. And that if they got together, they would have to both be adults. As man and woman, they would be adults. And so they could never get together because Joe doesn't want to grow up. And actually, Laurie doesn't want to grow up either. And so, but he thinks that he has to grow up because that's what everybody tells him he has to do.
Yes.
So then what happens is, and this is actually an extremely traditional reading that I'm about to say, but is that essentially, but I think the book bears it out. I actually didn't find the Laurie thing that queer, but so they couldn't grow up, they couldn't get married because that would make them grow up. And so what happens is essentially then he goes to Amy and Amy gives him a speech that is grow the fuck up.
That's right.
And then when he grows the fuck up, suddenly he's like, oh, I can't be with boys forever. I must be with a woman. Here is the feminine woman who I can be with, and I will become a man with her.
That's
and makes him a man.
Yeah.
And going back to the Sebastian Flight Brideshead, I realize this came before Brideshead, but in that I read them the other ways, I see it. That is exactly the idea of Brideshead, where Charles Ryder falls first in love with a boy, and they say he's the forerunner, that the boy teaches him how to love. And then it's because he learns how to love from the boy that he can finally be with the woman, Julia. And then in that one, they say that actually where he really should be with is God. And they name him God instead. But here, all cops, all her religiosity does not make them working together. But basically, I would say that Joe is the boyish training to teach before he could be a man with Amy.
Yeah.
And and because nobody wants him to be a man is why it's all happening off screen anyway. That would be my reading of it. Yeah. Like, I would love to do a femme for femme, Laurie's, trans femme, and he's in they're like just high style with their parasols on the boat.
Yeah.
That would totally be my jam. It isn't the model that I read in the text, which is probably disappointing for readers who would love to hear a femme for femme Laurie.
No, it's fine. I mean, I think.
No, I'm disappointing myself even, but I really
it's
think
okay. that's. Yeah. I mean, I think we're getting into the part of the book now where we are disappointed, right, by some of the choices that Alcott is making. I think Professor Bear remains a big disappointment for me.
A huge letdown. Yeah.
I've heard from readers who are passionate defenders, so I never want to talk too much shit. But I think the force of Joe's refusal to marry Laurie and saying, not just you, anybody. This is just simply not the life for me. It's just really undercut by Professor Bear coming in, even if Joe gets to essentially propose to him and dictate the terms of their marriage and say, if you marry me, I need to have a career. I need this and this. I need a room of my own. It's just, we're coming to the end of the book where really the more radical parts of this book are sort of giving way to the sentimental, let's wrap things up in the usual way. So yeah, I hear you. And I think the disappointing reading is there on the page in many ways. I think it lies there. I think maybe we can fanfic ourselves into a femme for femme reading.
I should have done it. I'm sorry.
No, I mean,
I'm sure the reading I've done has been done by scholars so many times.
I think it's there. I think maybe part of the reason why so much of it happens off camera is that Alcott was not having a particularly good time doing it.
Yeah, her heart, like I do not feel that the heart was in it in this scene. In this scene.
Yeah. No. I see her making peace with it the best she can. I think it's funny. Some of the most detailed sequences we get are of Laurie getting over Joe. She wants to just illustrate to people one more time, this isn't going to work. Don't get your hopes up.
Right?
It's funny. If we think about the way that the first book ended, right, Meg and John Brooke have a far more traditional marriage proposal. They're betrothed. Joe is unhappy about this, and Lori essentially proposes to be her friend forever, and then they'll go travel around the world when he graduates from college. So it's this parallel proposal, but it's entirely platonic, and he's proposing adventure, and we said earlier, running around as two boys, basically.
Yeah.
And ultimately, they can't have that, and that's sad. And yeah, I think as we get closer to the end, these little disappointments are just going to keep piling up. I think we kind of have to take what we can get in terms of Alcott really trying and going out of her way to make this really egalitarian.
Yeah.
They're rowing together. They're sitting side by side. It's very much not that Lori has overpowered and seduced Amy. That's not it at all. If anything, the opposite. And the support that he provides to Amy is emotional, right? He's there to for her to lean on. So it's a good model in that way of maybe a boy providing or a man providing emotional support and listening empathetically to a girl. But ultimately, I think
being told what to do by
her. Yes, completely. She calls him a wastrel and tells him to grow up, and he more or less listens, right? And it's this, what he's been taught by women kind of enables him to get through this sad time in his life without, I don't know, going to any European opium dens or whatever it would be.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
So reading it back, I can make peace with Amy and Lori, certainly to a much greater degree than I can Joe and Bear. I'm fine with this. Yeah. Even without doing my fun fanfic reading, I'm fine with what's happening on the page here. But
since I didn't do it, why don't you? I feel like the reader should get a femme for femme from you. I shouldn't have poo-pooed it. Like, please.
So my femme for femme reading here is basically with Lori, there is a feminine impulse always, even before he meets the March sisters, even before he enters the story, he's being bullied and called Dora by his schoolmates. And he says he hates boys. He hates socializing with boys. He simply doesn't fit in. And he's able to assimilate into the March family very easily and kind of become one of the crew. He especially benefits from being able to call Marmy mother. He idolizes her. He looks up to her. So he's really relishing in getting to have these relationships with women and girls for the very first time in his life, and to not be in an all-male environment for the first time in his life. We learn that he wants to be a musician like his late mother. That's very important to him. We learn almost nothing about his father, except that he loved this Italian woman enough to get disowned. Right.
Yeah.
But the person that he idolizes and wants to be like is his mother. For all he's talking about Mozart here, it's like where he got that from is his mother, who is an Italian pianist. So there's wanting to be with women, wanting to be like a woman in the sense that he wants to be like his mother. And the interest, it being into music, being very into flowers. He takes Joe through the greenhouse and is like, I need to explain to you what all these blossoms mean. I think Lori fits very naturally in with the March sisters. And Joe, I think, and is drawn to Joe for the fact that Joe represents a model of gender nonconformity. She isn't someone that he has to relate to necessarily as a girl.
Right.
And as he grows up, he does seem to more easily fit in with boys when he gets to college. He has a lot of college friends who are coming home. He makes this proposal to Joe. He's sort of following the path that's set for him, it seems. Well, whereas Joe has much more difficulty fitting into the role of a woman. Even as she grows up, it's still, she's just not about it. And she seems very bent on not marrying at all. But I think you could read in that, in Lori, a real desire to have a family over a career. Even now, there's no sense that he's involved in his grandfather's business at all. Yeah. He's interested in music and opera, but not as much to make a career for himself as to express something about how he feels. And then it's only that when he comes around and starts spending time with Amy again in private, and again, it takes on, he's providing an emotional support for her. He's rowing side by side to her. I think what you said before about how Amy tells him to grow up and he does and becomes a man through Amy, I think that's very true. But I also think that what we see here is a lot of Lori and Amy having a lot of private time where Lori can be like, yeah, I don't actually have to row this boat all by myself. You can sit next to me. So in a way of sort of the expectation there that he be a man is a little bit lower than it might be. So that's my trans femme reading of Lori.
I see it. I see it. I should definitely say that Brideside Revisited is basically my little woman. So I have a tendency to see everything in the Brideside Revisited model of the world, which is just my own personal bias.
Yeah. No, and I think you can definitely read that dynamic here. I loved what you said about how the boy taught him love and then the girl made him a man. We don't get the next step, which Laurie never goes to God, as far as I know.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think Joe is the boy who kind of teaches him nurturing and emotionality and love. And then Amy is the person who can be the wife in the next step, which is interesting to me. Yeah. Cause even now I don't get the sense that Laurie is a fully conventional man.
No.
Yeah. Well, Tori, I mean, thank you so much for being here. Where can people find you online? How can they support you in your work? What's going on?
I'm like not that much online these days.
Okay. Yep.
But I have this book. Yeah. I'm teaching this baby. Can read that. And then what am I doing? I'm obsessed with building a sauna right now. So it's like at least share with the world kind of thing. I'm like in a very honestly inward looking place.
Yeah.
So I have this land in Vermont and my big project. I went to Finland on a book tour this summer and I tried a sauna.
Yeah.
And I got obsessed with it. Like I never understood bathhouses. I was like, why would you get, I don't want to be sweaty with people, whatever. But the Finns have this ritual for sauna. And I got super obsessed with it. And I've been trying to build, and I don't know how to build. I've been like learning construction, but in order to build a true Finnish sauna next to a stream, like a wood fired traditional Finnish sauna.
I'm so jealous.
That is actually what I'm really into these days.
Fantastic.
I wanted to like promote my book or the other things. But
okay.
In fact, I'm not writing my book because I'm mostly obsessed with sauna.
Okay.
And so I have nothing to promote other than I will sauna for a year.
Okay.
And then you can probably find me on Instagram at Tori Peters, on Instagram. Okay. But I doubt that I'll be there for a while because the sauna is really my everything.
Okay. So is there some way that people can Venmo you Home Depot gift cards, anything like that?
That's what people should do. I don't want any Home Depot gift cards. I want people to go find the Finnish sauna.
Okay.
In near you, try out a Finnish sauna, which is, it's 12 minutes, super high heat.
Yep.
Then you throw some steam on, then you get in the plunge bath and the temperature drops, give you actual euphoria.
Oh my God.
Body gets messed up and doesn't know what to do. So we feel weird about this temperature change. Let's fix it by just releasing tons of endorphins.
Yeah.
And I think if people get a bunch of endorphins out there in the world, I care much more about that than Home Depot card. So go do a sauna and feel like you're doing it for me.
Okay. Yeah. Hear that, everyone. That's your homework. Is that the Wim Hof method?
It's not the Wim Hof method. Wim Hof doesn't do a sauna. No, Wim Hof just goes straight to the cold water.
Okay.
And it's just gritting, pure pain and stuff. If you do a sauna right, the cold feels like joy.
Okay.
And the heat is, it's lovely. It's not a endurance suffering thing. It's a being in your body.
Fantastic.
Truly thing.
Okay.
Yeah.
So I will definitely seek out the Finnish sauna in my area. Thank you for that, Tori.
Sure.
As always, I'm your host, Peyton Thomas. You can find me online at peytonthomas.ca. I'm taking a little baby step back into social media. I'm on Instagram at regularpeyton. You can buy my book, Both Sides Now, wherever you buy Detransition Baby. Package deal, just go for it.
Yeah.
And
that's what else you can do for me. People can get in your book.
Yes. Thank you, Tori. Yeah. Detransition Baby is quite a bit more NSFW. I mean, my book is for little high schoolers who are figuring out how to wear a binder for the first time, and yours is kind of in a different stratosphere, but I'm going to say good package deal.
People tell me like that your book is not allowed in high schools. I'm like, yeah, I can't.
I think that's one. It's like, maybe wait till college. There's a time and a place for everything, and it's called college to read Detransition Baby. No, but I love it. I endorse it wholeheartedly. Yes. Sorry.
Thank you. And if you're 12 and you want to read it, sure. Go ahead.
Okay. You're not going to stop you. Okay. And you can find the podcast on Instagram. We're at Joe's Boys Pod. Before I recorded this episode with Tori, I did a Q&A for Tori. We had a couple reader questions in here. So if you want to be able to ask future guests your questions, you need to be following us at Joe's Boys Pod. That's about all. Thanks so much, everyone. And thank you again, Tori. And we will see you next week.